In the previous, verses 4 through 13, Jeremiah had described the ingratitude of Israel. And now he's going to go into detail about the consequences of her apostasy. We know that he started out the chapter talking about her as in this ideal status, like a new bride, just all ecstatic and just so eager and gung-ho and faithful to her husband, which would be Israel's relationship to the Lord. And then she became ungrateful. And now we're going to see what the consequences of that ungratefulness are. Is Israel a slave? Or is he a homeborn servant? Why has he become a prey? One thing I want to say about the use of the term Israel, sometimes it's kind of hard to know whether he's talking about the 10 northern tribes or whether he's talking about the remnant, which would be Judah, or whether he's talking about both Judah and Israel. Sometimes there's, hints in the context that will help us out. But it really doesn't matter because Israel and Judah both chose the same path. They were just about 100 years apart. This question of why has he, that would be Israel, become a slave, become a prey? Probably the imagery here is of a prey to a lion. And, of course, if it's the 10 northern tribes, it would be Assyria. Now, Assyria is the instrument that God used to punish the 10 tribes, Israel, and took them into captivity. The young lions have roared at him. They have roared loudly, and they have made his land a waste. His cities have become destroyed without inhabitant. So based on that, I would say he's talking about the north. He's talking about the 10 northern tribes in the Assyrian captivity because he describes the consequences of the choice that Israel made to turn a deaf ear to the prophets that continually appeal to her, like Amos and others. And he was left, God was left with no alternative but to punish her. Now, lest Judah get the big head and say, well, they had it coming, he reminds them of something else, too. Verse 16 and 17. Moreover, the men of Memphis and Tophanes have shaved the crown of your head. Memphis was the capital of Egypt, about 30 miles south of Cairo. Tophanes was in the northeastern part of Egypt. It was on the main road. Let's see if I can get this back up here. Yeah, it's big enough to see. So you can see this dotted line going up from, Cairo's back down this direction. It's going up toward the Mediterranean and heading off toward the east and up the northeast. That was the main caravan route from Egypt up to Israel, on up through Damascus and all around to the Fertile Crescent and back down towards Babylon. Tophanes was a major commercial center, being right on the highway, I might say. Besides, there was a summer palace there for the Pharaoh. The artifacts from the area and the the ruins indicate just, you know, humongous buildings with all of the statues and the, you know, multiplicity of gods that the Egyptians were worshiped. Of course, you would find the same thing in Memphis also. So, the question is, in what sense would Memphis and Toppenes, which I think represent the powers of Egypt, have, quote, shaved the head, excuse me, of somebody up there towards Egypt, I mean towards Israel?
They killed Josiah.
Exactly.
Right. And then put them in subjection.
All right, exactly. Yeah, on their way north, they killed, you know, Josiah said, oh, I got to go out there and meet him at Megiddo. And, you know, they were on their way up to Carchemish. So in 609, you have that battle there, and they killed Josiah. So as far as Judah was concerned, they had not come out unscathed. Their head had been shaved in a figurative sense. Now, verse 17 really nails them. Have you not done this to yourself by your forsaking the Lord your God when he led you in the way? Well, we know that's a rhetorical question. You know, what would we say today? You shot yourself in the foot? They shot themselves in the foot. Except it was a lot worse than that because we're dealing with spiritual matters here. But they did it to themselves. They had nobody to blame but themselves. They had been begged and pleaded with and admonished and punished and you name it for hundreds of years, and they refused to listen. They turned their back on God, and so they're suffering the consequences of that. Now, go ahead.
Proverbs 13:15 says the way the transgression marks.
It is.
Everybody got how hard it is.
Yes. Exactly. So now one might think, okay, maybe they've learned their lesson. Well, we know better, don't we? But now, what are you doing on the road to Egypt to drink the waters of the Nile? And, or what are you doing on the road to Assyria to drink the waters of the Euphrates? Now, you remember they're in the middle. Egypt's down here and Assyria's over here. And they're trying to figure out Where to go to get the best drink of water, figuratively. In other words, who to get in bed with so that they can escape the wrath of the other. You know, they're in that vice. So, okay, Egypt's going to come, Assyria, and so, you know, and Babylon's coming into the picture now. And the Assyrian Empire's on the way out. And so they're looking around, who's going to be our best friend here? And God says, what are you thinking about? Going to Assyria or going to Egypt? Your own wickedness will correct you and your apostasies will reprove you. Know therefore and see that it is evil and bitter. For you forsake the Lord your God, and the dread of me is not in you, declares the God of hosts. Now here, you know, again, here's the absurdity of all this. We talked about last week choosing a broken cistern to put your water in and forsaking the fountain of living waters, which was God. That was verse 13. In verse 12 it said, be appalled, O heavens. I mean, you know, nobody in their right mind would do that. Well, look at this. Same force. They are putting more confidence in either Egypt or Assyria. In other words, they're putting their confidence in men instead of God. The dread of me is not in you. And right there is the heart of the problem. The fear of me. Whether you're talking about respect or whether you're talking about honor, you're talking about even the fear of punishment, which is certainly an element. None of the above. They had no well, he said, they turned their back on him. Well, all the way through here, he's just going to, this whole, prophecy of Jeremiah against them just points out one absurdity after another. But to ignore the consequences of their own wickedness and then put their trust in men, is there any wonder at all that God has not already wiped them out? Talk about patience and long suffering. There was the reform under Hezekiah, but then you kind of turned right around and here Manasseh came and he got worse than it had ever been for 40 something years. Josiah is doing the best he can, trying to get them to reform, but it's not going any deeper than the very top layer of their skin. It hadn't penetrated one iota past the surface, and so they're gonna suffer the consequences of that. Can you think of any modern day examples? Either, probably easier to think of something personal, where people just ignore the consequences of their own actions and then, start looking around for some other explanation or whatever, rather than facing up to the fact that, hey, I've got to accept the consequences for my own actions. Huh? Alcoholism?
Smoking.
Glory?
Yeah. Oh, about our
government. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why I said the others probably. Yeah, that opens up a little bit. But it's pandemic, really. It's every phase almost of life. My daughter had an experience with her son yesterday, 30 minutes late getting to the bus. It turned out they were 30 minutes late coming to the bus stop, bringing the kids home from school, and turned out that they had taken them off one bus, put them on another bus. And anyway, the mothers are standing there at the bus stop waiting, and finally call the school, and the people at the school are saying, I'm sorry, that's private information. We can't give out any information on your children over the phone. it's just gotten to the point where it's just ludicrous. Just insane. All the just stupidity that's out there. And then she goes up there this morning to talk to the principal and the vice principal. And they're accepting no responsibility for what happened, even though, whenever they filled out all the forms for the kids to ride the bus, they had to give, a dossier about that thick of every number on the planet that could be called in case there was some emergency and, all this kind of stuff. And then they thought, oh, we couldn't do anything. Yeah. That's just the way this world is right now, but there's nothing new under the sun, is there? Any other thoughts there through verse 19? Now he's going into detail regarding the choice that Judah had made. In particular, their fascination with Baal worship and the futility of it. It obviously had a strong appeal to them. He said, long ago I broke your yoke and tore off your bonds. Just like, you know, an ox's yoke being broken. But you said, I will not serve. I won't be a slave. For on every high hill and under every green tree you have lain down with a harlot. In the pagan cultures of that era, they had the idea that the closer they got to their deities up there, which means you had to climb a hill, then the closer you were, spiritually speaking, to them. And they were crazed with the idea that their gods and goddesses just spent most of their time in sexual escapades, and that therefore they wanted their subjects, which would be the people that were worshiping them, to do the same. And so there's a good deal of evidence that's been revealed in the ancient records and so forth that these people, and we're going to see how it's described here pretty graphically, that these people just craved with almost an insatiable appetite climbing up those hills so that they could do the same and commit all kinds of immoral sexual acts. And so when he said here, they climbed the hills and laying under every green tree, it's not just a figurative description of Israel's harlotry. It's both. Yet, he said, I planted you a choice vine, a complete faithful seed, like high-quality grapes in a vine dresser that so carefully selected that vine and planted it and nurtured it, expecting the greatest harvest from it. That's the imagery that the Lord uses here, describing what he did in taking the people as a nation and making them into a great nation, which would in turn suggest that he's expecting a great harvest from them. And what did they do? Verse 21, how then have you turned yourself before me into a degenerate shoot of a foreign vine? Here the finest specimen of a grape vine, carefully planted and nurtured, and then it's just a piece of garbage when they get through with it. That's the extent to which, I mean, you're talking about from one extreme to the other. That's the extent to which they had spurned the Lord. And then he uses another image, which I suppose every woman that's ever had a little boy can relate to this. Although you wash yourself with lye and use much soap, the stain of your iniquity is ever before me, declares the Lord God. I think it was a capital offense about 50 years ago or 60 years ago for a little boy to get a new pair of jeans and then run outside with them on and start playing and get grass stains on them. That was not good. Okay. Because those grass stains, especially the ones in Texas, they didn't come out. Okay, what kind of soap you used? He's saying that's the kind of stain that's on your soul here. With lye soap. My grandmother used to make lye soap. But I don't think it would get out all the stains. Nasty stuff. Yeah.
Going back to the previous example, that reminds me of him, the promise he made to Abraham with the faithful seed and the choice family, that Christ would come through their nation as fulfilling the prophecies to Abraham, and they're trying to ruin it.
They have no regard for the high calling to which he had brought them, that's for sure. Now, how then, verse 23, can you say, I'm not defiled and have not gone after the Baals? The lye soap wouldn't get it out. The other soap wouldn't get it out. The condition of the grapevine was as obvious as the nose on your face. And then obviously they had the audacity to say, I'm not defiled. I'm going after the Baals. Now what we know from history is, and we talked about this last week, I believe, they had convinced themselves that they could do both. They could, you know, they could mess around with the Baals a little bit, but after all, they were still saying that, hey, you know, we worship God. We know who He is. We honor Him. We're His chosen people. And so, what's wrong? What's the big deal? Yeah.
The Pharisees told Christ the same thing when they said, we've never been a slave to anyone.
Yeah. John chapter 8. Yeah. Oh.
Just the opposite of the truth.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Again, you believe what you want to believe, and you put your blinders on and see what you want to see. And that's what they were doing. That's what rationalization will get you. Is you can always figure out some way to excuse, you know, any little aberration and justify your actions. And that's what they were doing. He said, okay, look at your way in the valley. Know what you have done. You are a swift young camel entangling her ways, or literally running here and there. In the original, that expression literally means crisscrossing her tracks. In other words, just... Now, I don't know anything about camels, but from what I read was, these young... And this is in the original language. It's female, so apparently the young she camels were totally unreliable. Now I'm not a chauvinist, so don't, you know, I'm just telling you what I read about camels. Okay, not implying anything else. But they were just so fickle and unreliable and easy to disturb, and so, you know, flighty. You just couldn't use them. No telling which direction they were to go and to, you know, go crazy. And that's what he says Israel was like. Totally unreliable, fickle, just, you know, just going every which way. And they were. Assyria, Egypt, back and forth. And again, you read their history. Well, they pledged their allegiance to, oh yeah, we'll go up there and make a deal with Assyria. And then they, you know, that would blow up on them. Then they'd run to Egypt. And there was no end to it. See, that's where you've been. Ed?
They wanted to just blend in with the other nations instead of being a nation that was set apart.
Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah.
And they thought they could serve their gods and go after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now you think that's a graphic image. The next one even gets a little heavier. a wild donkey accustomed to the wilderness that sniffs the wind in her passion in the time of her heat, who can turn her away? All who seek her will not become weary. In her mouth they will find her. In her month they will find her. And again, I've never dealt with this kind of livestock either. I just know about a little bit about cows and a little bit about pigs, but not donkeys. But what I read was this female donkey in heat is so intent on mating that she runs around with her nose in the air sniffing. And of course, that would be sniffing for the mark that the male had left whenever he urinated. And that if she gets a whiff of it, there is no way in the world you can stop her. In fact, they become violent. Now, that's the intensity with which Israel had pursued idolatry and the worship of these Baals and their sex-crazed mania. Now, I often think I don't know how it could get any worse than it is right now in our country. But apparently, without television and without all the media hype, they were doing a pretty fair job of it back then. Because the description of it here is, and also in Ezekiel, they were a sex-crazed group. And they were justified on the basis of worship to these pagan deities. And then they had the audacity to say, well, what have we done wrong? I'm sorry?
We should have the temple every week.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They got the point, Ken, where rather than taking the shoot off the holy ground, they just decided that everything that they did
was God. Now he shifts imagery again. Keep your feet from being unshod and your throat from thirst. They were running to and fro and running around so, every which way, being so crazy, they wore their shoes out. That's the point. Don't wear yourself out chasing false gods until you drop from thirst. But you said, it's hopeless. No. For I've loved strangers, and after them I will walk. It's almost like an addict saying, well, I just can't help myself. Back up. Yeah, it's verse 25. It's hopeless. I can't help myself. I'm like, Lord, I'm born this way. So again, there was in their mind, it was better to serve the Baals. That's how twisted their mind was. So, I say, a very, very graphic illustration of their fascination with Baal worship, and of course, how futile it is. He continues, three more verses under that subject. As a thief is shamed when caught, so the house of Israel shall be shamed, they, their kings, their officials, their priests, and their prophets who say to a tree, "You are my father," and to a stone, "You gave me birth." There's a play on words here in the original. The Asherah was the female, but yet he says, "You are my father." I think there's satire in this. And to the stone, which is the male deity, he says, "You gave me birth." Well, I think that satire is to underscore the absurdity of their worship. The males don't give birth, and the females are not the father. "For they have turned their back to me and not their face, but in the time of their trouble they will say, 'Arise and save us.'" Oh yeah, when they can't get help from anywhere else, then they'll come with their hat in their hand and say, "Oh please, Lord, please won't you help us?" "But where are your gods, which you made for yourself?" Okay, you put your trust in those gods. All right, let them save you. "Let them arise if they can save you in the time of your trouble. For according to the number of your cities are your gods, O Judah." In other words, there are a whole bunch of them. And as long as they were getting what they wanted and things were going pretty smooth, they could care less about what they were doing or what God's will was. But there's going to come a time when they're going to say, "Oh, please, we need help." It'll be too late. We've got a lot of places in the New Testament where we've got the same message, don't we? About the rich man and Lazarus. "Oh, please, please, Father Abraham, just go down there and tell them. Well, they've got Moses, the prophets. Let them listen to them. I'll see a hand up.
Well, here, he makes a transition here, too, I think, Ken. Thinking at the point where they can think and talking about Israel a little bit. Get ready to break the old Judah.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Look, this, I'm talking to you. I'm not talking to them up there. I'm talking to you right here."
Yeah.
God knew this was going to happen. And that's why he told them in the beginning when they were going to the promised land to destroy everybody in it.
Oh, he warned, I say, yeah. Moses warned them. If you turn your back on God, this is what's going to happen to you. And so, yeah, that for 1,500 years or 1,000 years. Yeah, about 1,000 years. Just going back to Moses. Time. They've been told this hundreds of times. Yeah. And Judah, what he's going to point out, again, he's going to point this out too. And Judah, all they had to do was look up there at Israel and they could see. I mean, just right there, right on the doorstep, they could see what happened. The Israel, and then they think the same thing's not going to happen to them. "Why do you contend with me? You have all transgressed against me, declares the Lord." Now again, this is that word we talked about last week. And does the New King James say, argue your case there, Al, in verse 29? "Why do you contend with me?" Okay. This is the same word that we talked about when we started the chapter. I'm sorry? Yeah. "Therefore, I will contend with you." Again, it's that make a case like a lawsuit type thing. Okay, now why are they trying to make a case for their cause? Well, you can't argue your case. I mean, you don't have a case to argue. You've transgressed. You violated the law of God. In vain, I've struck your sons. They accepted no chastening. Your sword has devoured your prophets like a destroying lion. Yeah, they killed the prophets. Remember the Hebrews 11, and of course, back over there, Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 26, that charges. If they didn't like the message, they killed the prophet killed the messenger. Oh, generation, heed the word of the Lord. Have I been a wilderness to Israel? Or a land of thick darkness? Well, that's another rhetorical question. Absolutely not. He's been just the opposite. He's been their light. He's provided for them so bountifully. Why do my people say, we are free to roam? We will come no more to thee. You talk about an expression of utter defiance, like we don't care what you say, we're going to do it our way no matter what. That's the attitude they had. Oh, yeah. Well, again, he goes to the sexual imagery. Can a virgin forget? He gets down to that here in just a minute in verse 33. But can a virgin forget her ornaments, or a bride her attire? Can you imagine a bride going to her wedding and forgetting her dress? I doubt it. What all of the ornaments that marked her as a married one? No, that's not likely to happen. That's another rhetorical question. Yet my people have forgotten me days without number. All that he had done for them for so long, I mean, this is just the most reprehensible behavior. You know, it's just as absurd as a bride forgetting that she was going to get married, or maybe even that she was married. No. Yet that's exactly what they had done. Also, on your skirts is found the lifeblood of the innocent poor. You did not find them breaking in, but in spite of all these things. Oh, wait a minute. I skipped verse 33. Got to go back. How well you prepare your way to seek love. Therefore, even the wicked women you have taught your ways. Yeah, this goes back to that harlotry imagery. Harlot imagery. And this wasn't an accident. They didn't just accidentally walk down the road one day and, oops, you know, kind of stumble into this trap. No, you prepared your way. They had a plan to accomplish this evil purpose, and that was to seek love, that is, an unfaithful relationship with these idols, and, of course, the harlotry and the immorality that went along with it. In fact, here's how bad it was. Therefore, even the wicked women you've taught your way. She was so evil, she could teach the prostitutes a trick or two. That's the point. It doesn't get any worse than that. You think you could teach a prostitute how to be more wicked? Apparently. Again, I realize this is a high, I'm sure this is a hyperbole, but that just shows how low they had sunk. You just, I mean, In their culture, you couldn't get any lower than a prostitute. And yet Israel or Judah was teaching the prostitutes how to be worse than they were. Also on your skirts is found the lifeblood of the innocent poor. Again, nothing was unthinkable to them. You did not find them breaking in, but in spite of all these things, you said, I am innocent. Surely his anger is turned away from me. Behold, I will enter into judgment with you because you say, I have not sinned. There is absolutely no excuse. You know, if a thief is breaking in the house, you had the right to, you know, defend your property and so forth. But they say, you didn't find anybody breaking. There's no reason. There is absolutely no way in the world that there is any excuse. Again, going back to this idea, where we're going to argue, you're going to argue your case against God. Why in the world would you try to do that? You don't have a case. There is absolutely no excuse for this behavior. Yet, in spite of all that, they're saying, I'm innocent. Surely his anger turned away from me. Behold, I will enter into judgment with you because you say, I have not sinned. Why do you go around so much changing your way? Again, this fickleness of that crazed she-camel that he described back there a while ago. Also, you shall be put to shame by Egypt as you were put to shame by Assyria. See, they were looking to Egypt for their help now. It's not going to be there. From this place also, you shall go out with your hands on your head, which was a sign of grief. For the Lord has rejected those in whom you trust, and you shall not prosper with them. So, there is no way in the world that Israel could say, oh, well, we don't deserve this judgment. No, we're innocent. Oh, no. No, we're just, you know, we might have been guilty of a little indiscretion here and there, but no, no, not this. You just can't get a much more graphic picture of sin and its consequences than you get right here. Some of it's a little coarse, I realize that, but that's the point. That is how God sees it. And would that people today, even us, would be impressed by that, because it's the one of the most effective tools that Satan has, and that is to desensitize people to sin. Because if you become desensitized, then, you know, if it doesn't bother your conscience, then pretty soon it doesn't bother your sense of right or wrong, and then Satan's got us right where he wants us. And Satan's doing a pretty fair job of that today. Is. Who? We're not guilty. Why?
John dealt with that in 1 John chapter 22. He says in verse 5, this is the message which we have heard of him, declaring to you God is light. In him is no darkness at all. We say that we walk in the I have fellowship with him and walk in darkness.
We're a liar and the truth's not in us. That's what he said. Yeah.
You can't see how close you can get to it. Get to the bottom of that in person.
No. Betty and I were talking about this the other day. About the power of the lust of the flesh. It just, you know, it's just amazing at what people will give up to pursue the lust of the flesh. We've got a situation right now we're dealing with a fellow that's decided he wants to shack up with another woman and give up his family, kids, and his soul. I've lost count of how many people that I've known personally that have done that. That's exactly what we're dealing with here, the lust of the flesh. To climb up on those hills and participate in these orgies, these sex orgies, in the name of worship. And of course, what's done today is, it's not done in the name of worship, it's done in the name of, well, it's my right, it's my feelings, it's my body, and I get to do what I want to do with it. And that's the biggest lie that Satan's ever told. I emailed this fellow today and I told him, I said, if that's the way you're thinking, you're listening to Satan. That is a huge lie that Satan's been telling for a long time and people have been buying it. How absurd. He wants to justify himself. Just like Israel was. Oh, they want to argue their case against God. It's just, again, Satan has some powerful weapons in his arsenal. But we're not indefensible. We've got the defense that'll repel him if we just use it. Shield of faith, sword of the Spirit. Helmet of salvation. We can repel every one of his advances, but it's our choice. Israel had the same choice to make. Same choice. They didn't have to turn to Egypt, and they didn't have to turn to Assyria, and they didn't have to play with the harlotry of the pagan cult, idolatry, but they did it because they wanted to. They wanted to. Keep thinking of those kids. Yep, sure enough, they're walking in the door. I thought they'd be there coming through there just about any time. Okay, Lord willing, we will move on to chapter 3 next week.